The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, we begin with a fascinating article about the navigational power of zero. Surely you remember maps and studying them as early as maybe third or fourth grade. Well, you know, we learned about longitude and latitude and polar caps and all that. Well, this article, which is from the December 2024 issue of National Geographic, features pictures of the year by various explorers around the world. And we'll be featuring some of these a little bit later, but we're going to start with Matthew Chwatstick's article. Now, as the editors explain, and I quote, "For centuries, geographers, astronomers, and mariners around the world set their own standards for longitude without any agreement on a universal baseline." Now, here's why it took so long to agree on the prime meridian, okay? So let's go exploring and learn more. The navigational power of finding zero. For centuries, geographers, astronomers, and mariners around the world set their own standards, but keep in mind it took a while to get the one that we have today. And we begin by looking down atop what looks like a globe, but it's spread out on two pages in color in this graphic. And we're first going to read about the introduction. And it says, "Today, geographers use the time-honored system of intersecting lines to pinpoint places on the globe. Latitude running west to east has always had a convenient origin. The equator, which divides Earth into northern and southern hemispheres." So that's something we learn early on, is it not? "And then longitude running north to south determined what's east or west. Now, it started out without such an easy demarcation. Early cartographers chose their own zero line, or prime meridian, often centered on their capital. And that worked until it didn't. The myriad prime meridians led to confusion in maps and sea charts, timekeeping, and global maritime commerce. At the 1884 International Meridian Conference in Washington, D.C., delegates from 25 countries recommended the worldwide adoption of the prime meridian running through the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England, as the world's baseline for longitude and standardized time. But traditions were hard to break. It took four decades for the last holdouts, including France and Portugal, to adopt this first universal global positioning system." And this story is about how it evolved. Now, we're going to look at the first on the right side as we overlook the North Pole, looking straight down. And as we glance down to our left, we see Asia and Australia and other Pacific coast and Southern Ocean and Indian Ocean continents. And we read first, "Looking to the equator marks the midpoint between Earth's poles. All lines of latitude run parallel to it and are therefore referred to as parallels." Now, prime meridians. "By era of main use," it reads, "3rd century BC, earliest use of latitude and longitude, and this continued until about 1600 AD. About that time, we have the age of modern map-making begins until full adoption of a Greenwich meridian." And how long do you think it took to get to that? 1914. Can you believe that? "While solving the space and time confusion, before a single shared prime meridian was selected, other lines were chosen for cartographic convenience, cultural tradition, or national pride. After the Greenwich prime meridian was adopted, it became the basis for what we enjoy as standardized time today. Recognizing different origins, a meridian, from the Latin word meaning noon, is a line that indicates where the sun is directly overhead at midday. In other words, we get our time zones as a result of this. Anchoring the hemispheres, the equator and all meridians are called great circles because the plane of their lines passes through the center of the planet, dividing it into equal hemispheres." Now we jump to the right side. We're looking now at Europe and Africa, another part of Asia, or what would be called Asia Minor, as well as the North and South American continents, and Indian Ocean again, and Atlantic Ocean and other seas related. Now, as we read this section, Rethinking Ancient Standards, Greek geographers often used Faro, F-E-R-R-O, one of the Canary Islands, the western limit of their known world, and exploration then expanded horizons. And that was their prime meridian, in other words. Now, some other things that we learned here are the various places that were often used, like Alexandria, also Krakow in Warsaw in Poland, and then we also have Budapest, and then Stockholm and Rome. Some of these were also prime meridian locations because the particular cartographers lived there and they wanted to honor them. Then we have a proliferation of primes, nearly 40 other prime meridians used before the universal adoption again in 1914 of the Greenwich Line. And by the way, that's just outside of London, if you're curious as to exactly where it is in the UK. Now, continuing to improve accuracy, global positioning systems now measure latitude, longitude, and also height with sea level at zero to plot locations more precisely. So it's a topographic map, in other words. It covers all three dimensions. This computational process accounts for other factors such as gravity and irregularities in Earth shapes to be even more exact. Well, how about that? So that two-page graphic gives us an idea of how things were done and also shows us what we see today in modern maps, as well as enjoy modern standard times, right? Well, now that we've had a quick lesson in modern-day map-making and navigation, let's go from here to several of the photos in the National Geographic Editor's Say captured the wonder of our world today, and I should say, really, during 2024, really. And as they note, National Geographic photographers ventured to places far and wide to capture the year's most fascinating images, and here are their best and the stories behind them. And we're going to feature a few of these stories, and some of these were written by writer and editor Gloria Liu, but we may mention some others too along the way because others popped in occasionally to add their comments. We first have a photograph by Bertie Gregory called Taking the Plunge. We are standing on an ice shelf, yes, an ice shelf that has to be multiple stories high with a bunch of penguins looking down, and one's decided to take flight into the sea below. A young emperor penguin jumps off a 50-foot cliff for its first swim. The species normally breeds on low-lying sea ice, but some colonies have been found on higher and more permanent ice shelves, behavior likely to become increasingly common with climate change. Left by their parents a month earlier, the chicks must fend for themselves and find food by hunting in the sea. So there we have our first hunter-gatherer heading into the water. Next, we open a page with people with very special glasses looking up at the sun. It's called Total Eclipse of the Heart, the photograph taken by Aaron Huey. And the location is Russellville, Arkansas. On April 8th, a total solar eclipse occurred across North America from Mexico to Canada. In the path of totality, this southern city hosted elope at the eclipse, where more than 100 couples said, "I do," including Nicholas Blackwell and Katie Balcom, and they're pictured here with their children. And after the nuptials, wedding-goers viewed the four-minute wonder of the eclipse. Wow. Now, dining at dusk, we have this interesting photograph. It looks like a small tucked away cave and with lots of greenery tucked away into the crevices of the rocks that are above the opening of the cave, and lots of birds or bats. I think they're bats, as a matter of fact. It's this Concan, Texas. Frio Bat Cave in southern Texas, the spring and summer home of approximately 10 million Mexican free-tailed bats. Most nights around sunset, bats fly out in a coordinated stream to feed primarily on moths. You think maybe it'll finish in 10 minutes, back to fresh, he says, but their takeoff continues for 2 hours, and I certainly can understand why. By the way, Babak's took the photo. There's just, you can't even count all the shadows of bats that are in this photograph. It would be nearly impossible. Well, and that brings us to our next article, a little more lengthy, and so a little more information for you. This is from Nuyuki, Kenya, and taken by Amy Vital. It's called New Hope for Rhinos. Only two northern white rhinoceroses remain on the planet, both females protected by armed guards around the clock at Ole Pejeta Conservancy in Kenya. The subspecies of white rhino has been hunted to functional extinction for its horn, coveted for carvings, and unproven medicinal uses. But a promising solution has emerged. In January, scientists from an international project called BioRescue announced that they had for the first time achieved a pregnancy after using in vitro fertilization, or IVF, to transfer a southern white rhino embryo into a southern white rhino surrogate. Southern white rhinos, once near extinction themselves, are now the most popular species of rhino, thanks to an over a century of conservation efforts. Now, the success was bittersweet. Before scientists could confirm the pregnancy, the surrogate mother died from an unrelated bacterial infection. A necropsy revealed that she was pregnant. While the moment was heartbreaking, Amy Vital says, it proved that IVF is viable in rhinos. The BioRescue team plans to transfer a northern white rhino embryo into a southern white rhino surrogate in early 2025. The procedure may save other rhinos. Three of the five species are critically endangered. For Vital, whose work documented steps to save the rhinos of the past 15 years, will be included in a forthcoming National Geographic film. The fetus is a symbol of the group's determination. The thing that drives this team is their optimism, she says. They're just not giving up. And this particular photo shows the moment of joy tinged with a somber acknowledgement of the journey's cost. And it shows a scientist in gloved hands, and he's holding a 70-day-old fetus of a rhino conceived through in vitro fertilization. Well, where faith converges is our next photograph, and this is in the Pamir Mountains of Tajikistan, photographed by Matthew Paley. Now, this shrine in an area with a rich history of animism, Zoroastrianism, and Buddhism is maintained by local Waki people, who are Ismaili Muslims. A tree that fell years ago on the shrine's tomb, which is adorned with horns from ibex and sheep, was left in a place as custom dictates. And it almost looks like the scene from a horror movie, but it's quite interesting. A lot of earth tones here, along with green canopy above from the various vines and trees that grow from these gnarled roots and tree trunks. Quite impressive, and we see a gentleman there on his knees doing his meditation. Now, we switch to an imperiled haven. This is in Siwa Oasis, Egypt. This was taken by Mohammed Kelito. Now, in Egypt's vast desert, Siwa Oasis supports a town of 35,000 people. It also attracts tourists who come for camel rides, sandboarding in ancient ruins and salty lakes. But these bodies of water are a sign of trouble in paradise. Now, before the 1980s, Siwa's only source of water was 200 naturally flowing springs. To expand agriculture in the region, farmers drilled thousands of wells to access groundwater and the aquifers below. The wells supplied more water for irrigation, but without a well-planned drainage system, in places, excess water produced daily drainage leaks and caused waterlogging and salinization of the soil. Now, ironically, too much water in this desert attraction is leading to the deterioration of agriculture, killing cash crops like date palms, which are crucial to creating the humid microclimate of the oasis. Siwa's not alone. More than 33 million acres of oases around the globe degraded into deserts between 1995 and 2020. And this one is in Egypt's western desert. And it does show a sand dune adjacent to the edges of this oasis, and in the middle, of course, these declining palms that are dying because of the changes taking place. Now, we go to the atomic aftermath. This is in Kashi, India. The photograph is by Chinky Shukla. Now, for almost a decade, Chinky Shukla has been documenting the impact of underground nuclear tests that India conducted in 1974 and again in 1998. Sisters Shahida, Sibira, and Kemal Khatun were preparing food at home when they felt the blast in the 90s. Today, as they support their families as daily laborers on nearby farms. Now, of Muslim faith, they chose to cover their faces with their shawls for this photograph. And they are standing looking out over this vast, desolate area with just a little greenery. dotting the skyline. Now we have a centuries-old love song photograph in Springfield, Illinois, photographed by John Stenmeyer. Periodical cicadas spend 13 to 17 years in the ground, emerging only to reproduce. And last May and June, for the first time in 221 years, brood the 8 with a 17-year cycle and brood 9 with a 13-year cycle emerged simultaneously in the Midwest and southeastern United States, respectively, filling the air with vibrations as they called out to a mate. And many of you will remember the sounds of cicadas during the summer, no doubt. Now we move into some deep knowledge. We have here a picture of three men dressed in white with helmets and lights in a deep, dark cave just surrounded by stalagmites, stalactites, and all that sort of thing, and lots of rock formation. This is in the Nguni province of Gabon. In Bongolo Cave, researchers joined by a bat worked to create a record of past rainfall by analyzing stalagmites, calcium carbonate formations, created by water dripping over thousands of years into the cave floor. Now, the Western African Paleoclimate Project's goal is to understand the climate threats to agriculture across the region. And this photograph is by Robbie Schoen, by the way. Next, we're going to be tracking the elusive tiger. This will be in Odisha State of India, and the photograph is taken by Prasenjeev Yadav. It's a beautiful, what they call a black tiger, and we're going to learn more about that. And the Simalipal Tiger Reserve covers more than 1,000 square miles in eastern India and is home to the world's only wild population of pseudo-melanistic tigers, also called black tigers, for their extra-wide stripes. So just picture a tiger like you've normally seen, and then increase the size of the stripes, and that's what you have. The unique color pattern results from a genetic mutation found solely in the Simalipal population. About half of the 27 tigers living there are called black tigers. Now, Simalipal tigers are skittish and shy. Even longtime residents of the villages within the reserve told Prasenjeev Yadav that they had never seen one. To photograph the tigers, Yadav set up camera traps with infrared triggers on 24 trails, three of which ultimately saw regular tiger activity. However, the tigers often seemed a sense of change on the path and headed off trail out of the camera's range. Even if my camera was camouflaged, he explains, I want to avoid it. Other wildlife, he says, like monkeys and elephants, played with and broke his cameras. Now, Yadav kept a 14 to 16-hour day managing his equipment, then improving his techniques to avoid detection by these animals. Now, he eventually got this image of a young female tiger that we see here on this page, one of just a few photos captured of the black tigers over 60 days inside the reserve. And we also have an insert color photo of Yadav on his hands and knees crawling slowly to one of the camera settings so he can work some more on that without being spotted by the animals. Well, our next picture is like it's inside a giant bird cage. Yes, lots of birds, lots of parrots, macaws, that type of thing. And it's found in Benson, Arizona, with the photograph taken by Christy Hem Klook. Now, macaws are highly social birds that live on average of 40 to 60 years and often exhibit stressed behavior in captivity. This makes them challenging pets, so many end up in the Oasis Sanctuary. It provides permanent care for 800 parrots, including macaws. Now, here we have a picture of Janet Trumbull, who runs the refuge and is trying to coax them down with walnuts, which is a favorite food. So they're kind of flying around or sitting on various perches hung around this aviary. And quite a colorful picture with all these different colors, reds, greens, blues. I mean, some gorgeous-looking birds, no doubt about it. Then we move to the shepherding change. This is in Concesti, Romania. Romania. Now, intimately familiar with this land, his family has worked for centuries. Constantin Dansila, in a traditional sheepskin coat, and I mean, he is definitely decked out in this coat. This thing looks like a something from a movie, but it's quite colorful, to say the least. And he has seen significant changes in the environment, and that's prompted him to adapt his farming practices. With less snow in winter to supply streams, grass in the valley has become scarce, so he now drives his flock higher into the alpine meadows. This photograph was taken by Jasper Duist. Now we have a fertilizing frenzy. This is in British Columbia, Canada. Pacific herons spawn off the coast of Vancouver. This picture looks like a blurred vision of a green background, and then there's a tiny, tiny on one side, just a very small black with a slightly brown triangular-shaped hole there. And what we have here is Pacific herons spawn off the coast of Vancouver Island every spring. So this is a picture of the island amid the sea there. And females release up to 20,000 eggs each. Then males release the melt called semen. The event causes a visual display that typically lasts about a day and then provides valuable food source for other animals, including a sea lion that we see swimming nearby the island. And the photograph is taken by Ryan Tidman. Well, our next stop is Dangerous Crossroads, and this is in Zuma, Zambia. Jasper Duist is our photographer. Jasper Duist was documenting an international effort to protect trans-border wildlife corridors when he heard that an elephant had been killed the night before by a car on the M10 highway. That's outside of Zuma Nyagwazi National Park. Now, a passenger in the vehicle also died. Elephants must cross the M10 to reach the Zambezi River, their only water source during hot, dry months in the Ngrazi. Now, human-animal interactions are increasing as roads, villages, and farms encroach upon habitat for animals and other wildlife. In addition, climate change raises temperatures and alters rainfall patterns, forcing animals and humans into more frequent competition for resources like water. In the past, locals saw only the occasional elephant, but now, they told Duist, the animals raid their crops and leave paths of destruction as they move through villages in larger numbers. You could feel the tension, Duist says, of the conflicts. At the accident scene, bystanders gathered and buses arrived with schoolchildren. Despite their generally adversarial relationship with elephants, many villagers had not seen one close up, and people approached to touch the animal and stroke his trunk in awe. Conservation measures like the wildlife corridors that Duist had been photographing addressed the needs in both animals and humans for water and land resources that are ever more important. It's about creating an infrastructure of coexistence, Duist says. So he has a picture of this huge flatbed truck pulling, I guess, is feed for these animals. And we have an elephant that's laying down in the sand sunning, and the natives all walking up and petting him and looking him over. And he's just gently laying there, just swatting his tail occasionally and letting his trunk go back and forth. Quite an interesting picture, to say the least. A boom with a view is our next one, and this is Antigua, Guatemala, the photograph by Peter Fisher. Fuego volcano has been erupting continually since 2002. Now, a one-day hike up its dormant twin, Acatenango, and across a valley rewards adventurers with a view from Fuego's ridgeline. Eruptions can occur multiple times a day. In this particular one, we see on the right side of this two-page photograph, people in a very dark-colored mountain. This was taken early in the evening, I'm sure. And they're standing there observing this. And then on the left side, this huge plume of smoke and fire coming from the volcano. Quite an impressive picture. Now we have a very interesting picture. It's kind of a very specialized, the focused part, it looks like something coming out of a cocoon of sorts, but as it gets clearer, you realize it's an insect because you see part of the insect's face and body and antenna coming out. It's called A Tiny Breakthrough, the photograph taken by Ingo Arndt, and it's in Konstanz, Germany that this occurred. Ingo Arndt worked with the University of Konstanz to build a nest for viewing the breeding behavior of wood ants, normally hidden in forest mounds. Arndt watched female colony workers clean eggs, larvae spin cocoons, and hatchlings like this one that we see in the photograph. They open the cocoons with their mandibles before workers help cut them out. So they need a little help to finish the birthing process, but there they are in this photograph. Next up, petal pushers. And this is just a beautiful picture of a lot of flowers laying on a white tablecloth, it looks like, and bowls of flowers surrounding these hands that are working with these flowers. This is in Kalat Umgona, Morocco. Now, each spring, Morocco hosts a festival to celebrate the rose harvest. Pickers, mostly women, pluck buds early in the morning before the flowers open and release their aroma. The buds are then hand-sorted. The best are distilled into rose oil and rose water. The others dried for tea or garlands. Rina Effendi took this photograph, and it's quite impressive because it shows you how they do this delicate work with their hands. And these hands are busy, and there's several pairs of hands we see, along with several bowls and lots of flowers or rosebuds. Our next picture is quite a contrast. It's undersea, underwater. Lots of fish on one side and a couple of fish just lingering around on the left side of this two-page graphic. It's entitled When Waters Collide. It's a photograph by Jason Gully. Fanning Springs State Park, Florida, is the location. Now, just after sunrise, snook and mullet dart between the dark, tannic Suwannee River and the clear Fanning Spring, one of 1,000 freshwater springs in Florida. A late winter flood caused the colder, denser river water to creep under the warmer water in the channel connecting the river, or spring, to the river. So here we go, these fish in a large school of fish, and there's dozens of them, and these two other fish just going to the side looking for some food, I presume. Well, will travelers find a lost Inca city is our next little short article, and we'll be reading excerpts from them. We're high in the Peruvian clouds. The hard-to-reach ruins of the Shacochiaro are spared to the crowds that flock to Machu Picchu, and that could soon change. This is written by Lucian Chauvin, and the photograph is taken by Victor Z. Llamas seem to graze everywhere in Peru's mountains, but none are quite as memorable as the herd at Shacochiaro. Fashioned out of white rocks and embedded in gray schist walls, 24 beguiling llamas have stood fixed in stone for centuries. There is nothing else like this in the Andes, says Gori Tumi Echevarria, who specializes in prehistoric rock art and has worked at the sprawling pre-Columbian archaeological complex since 2005. Now, since that year the llamas were discovered back then, it was an artistic innovation that occurred in the 16th century and was never repeated. In the Andes in southern Peru, Shacochiaro is a cousin to the more frequently visited Machu Picchu, just 27 miles northeast. The complex of structures was created by Inca architects. Now it includes ceremonial halls, chambers that once held mummified remains, intricate farming terraces, and hundreds of buildings where Inca communities worked and lived. Now, the star attraction for travelers and archaeologists are the llamas in perpetual procession toward the ruined central plaza where their live relatives may have been sacrificed. The route to the 10,000-foot-high Shacochiaro is not for the faint-hearted. Visitors typically fly inland from Lima to Cusco, and the site is accessible only by foot or human mule. It takes hikers 2 or 3 days to trek there and back along a 39-mile trail that often hugs the cliffside of the Apurmac River, which rages below in our photograph. And that brings us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. Excuse my voice. It gets a little foggy at some times. But nonetheless, we stayed the course and hope that you'll join us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.